Morning, everybody. So today, I'm going to talk about the last three lines of faith, heart, mind, inscription, which I've talked about. Paul knows how many numbers. I don't know, something like 18 times. So after this, I'll have nothing to talk about. And we'll just show up together and see what happens, which is what we do anyway, isn't it? More or less. So the last three lines are, for those of you who don't know, this is written by the third ancestor in the Zen lineage. And he didn't know he was the third ancestor in the Zen lineage. He didn't know there was such a thing as Zen. But four generations later, people loved this poem. And they said, oh, he's our ancestor. As we're creating this new Zen sect, he's our guy, right? That's the way human beings do things. Even with Suzuki Roshi, who was so famous. Now, when he was alive, people were coming and going. But after he died and his book came out, everybody wanted to be connected to him. Same with Katagiri Roshi. Well, that's the way we are as human beings, right? Okay, so the last three lines. If this is for you, there is no need to worry about non-perfection. To live in this faith is non-dual, because the non-dual is one with a trusting mind. Beyond all language, in it there is no yesterday, no tomorrow, no today. So last time I said a little bit about, if this is for you, there is no need to worry about non-perfection. I'll start there. So the irony about Zen practice for so many of us is that we start it with some real intention to ameliorate our worry, right? We want to ameliorate our worry. We know we spend too much time just not being in the world, but worrying about it. Worrying about what we should have done or might have done or might do or should do or someone else wants us to do. But then what happens? Well, then we start worrying about our Zen practice. We make the commitment to Zen, and we have a new worry, which is, oh, is my commitment good enough? What about her commitment in comparison with mine? What about his? Oh, how am I doing? And then we worry. I've been practicing for so long, and what good is it, or something, right? Maybe I should do this, and we try this, and then we come back to Zen practice, we try something else. So it becomes a source of more worrying. Well, this is the way human beings are. Don't blame this on Zen, please. Don't blame it on anything. Don't blame it on yourself. It just seems to be human nature. So, as I said last time, we make a lot of mistakes. We have a lot of successes, and when we cry when we do something wrong, maybe you guys don't. I do. Whatever wrong might be, with something we let ourselves down or let someone else down, and when we're successful, yeah, that's fine. But it's the extra part, the sort of worrying about it, that isn't necessary, and that through our practice we can begin to just let go of and realize that we are not just this mass of worrying and comparing, that we are the Buddha nature, that our true nature is, as T.S. Eliot said after he was reading Hindu scriptures for a long time, and then he became an Episcopalian, but a mystic Episcopalian, the still point of the turning world. That's T.S. Eliot's term. Buddha nature. We all have it. We can all return to it. We can all get a little taste of it, or a big taste of it, because it's our true nature. but we become a victim of our failure, and then that's all we are. We're just a failure, just a massive failure. Instead of just being like, last time I was talking about Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan had a natural zen in a way. Because he wasn't a good athlete, right? Everybody thinks he was this wonderful athlete. I talked about this last time. He wanted to get into the high school, he wanted to be in the high school varsity. He didn't make it into the high school varsity. He practiced. He wanted to get into North Carolina State. He really wanted to play basketball for them. They turned him down. He practiced. He wanted, they got two teams in the NBA he really wanted to join, the two best teams. They both turned him down. He practiced. And then we think, oh, Michael Jordan, wonderful natural athlete. Oh, yeah, okay, you can say that. He refused to become a victim of his failure. He just refused. And my teacher, my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, he came over to this country when he was how old? 55 years old. What had he done in Japan? Not much of anything. He hadn't done much of anything. He mostly failed. He had. If you read his big book, you'll see that he mostly... This is not the big book. This is his big book. Crooked Cucumber. You'll see that he mostly failed. He had hardly any disciples. He lived in this country temple. He never got to go talk at a heiji. They never invited Suzuki Roshi to talk at a heiji with the big guys. He wanted to come to the United States when he was like in his 20s. He never got to come. He wasn't much of anything. But he depended on something other than just his own ideas. Buddha nature. Still on the point. Right here, always. So when he came to the United States, all of a sudden everything flowered and it happened to be the right time and the right place. Lots of teachers would say, oh, this is the wrong time and the wrong place. But not for him. Because he saw something. He experienced some stillness. And he saw that these counterculture people all had some potential. Even though they were totally off the wall from a Japanese perspective. Totally off the wall. Much more from a Japanese perspective than an American perspective. Do you know what I mean? So that's why we practice. Not to worry about perfection or non-perfection, but to come back to this Buddha nature. Just to come back to this awake nature. So Michael Jordan, as I said last time, never became a victim of his failures. But at one point, he almost became a victim of his success. Hard not to, huh? If you're Michael Jordan. And I think I talked about this last time. So what happened was, he went to NBA championship after NBA championship with the Chicago Bulls. Everybody said, he's the best athlete. You're the best athlete in the world. You're the best basketball player in the world. And he began to think, I am. I am. The minute you think I am a failure or a success, you freeze. You lose your Buddha mind. You don't really lose it. It's always here. But you overlook it. You overlook it. So, he played baseball for a year. He didn't practice during that year at all. He went back to Chicago Bulls, and what happened? No NBA championship. Big disappointment. So, what did he do immediately after losing that championship? He started practicing again. Just like a little child, not knowing. Just practicing. If Michael Jordan can do that, and he doesn't even know anything about Zen, maybe we can do it too. Maybe it's possible. So I talked last time about my adolescence. I totally failed at everything in my adolescence. I won't go through all the details again today. It's too embarrassing. I did it last time. I totally failed at everything. I didn't have many friends. I was felt awkward with women, with girls. I didn't go to classes because, well, I talked about that last time. Because I was afraid I was going to fail. And everybody said I was success, but I didn't want to fail. So instead of going to classes, I thought, well, if I don't go to classes, then I can still be a success. Because I say, well, I just didn't study that. You know, we do these things, right? We human beings are pretty smart, but often to our own detriment. Often to our own detriment. So then, when I was in my early 20s, I began practicing Zen. And I had some wonderful experiences at the still point of the turning world. Wow! I never knew that. A fool like me could have those experiences. A foolish post-adolescent could have those experiences. And so I began to think, this is something I can do. The minute you think this is something I can do, be careful, because if you're going to get fixated on it, you're expecting something, you're comparing it to someone else, and you want more of it. I want more of it. More of it. More stillness. Right? More stillness. More just total spaciousness. Not a care in the world. Right? I experienced it this many times. Maybe I can experience this many more times. And so I was looking around, getting away from, as I've talked before, from my dumb teacher who didn't give me much of anything where I could really, really become successful. Go way beyond anything T.S. Eliot, he didn't know anything about Zen, said or did, right? To the core. So that even my wife would think, wow, he is incredible. That's another story. So then I saw Suzuki Roshi in the hall or in his office or something, and he said to me, you have a great treasure. And he went like this. He said, you have a great treasure. Don't let anybody take it from you. Because I was looking around for something better. We're always looking around for something better. It's never good enough. It's never good enough. We look around for something better. We want the community to get along better. We want the community to grow. We want our friends to really be our intimate friends, not to just be our superficial friends. But Suzuki said to me, he pointed to his nose, he said, you have a great treasure. Don't let anybody take it from you. That's your Buddha nature. You have a great treasure. And it stopped me. Well, it didn't stop me at first, but I went home and I started thinking about it. And then it really slowed me down. Really slowed me down. So then I just came back and went to Zazen the next morning and forgot about going anywhere else for the next 2 or 3 years. It just stayed with him. Because we have a great treasure. And we're kind of giving it away because we want. I think if we give it away, we'll get more back. Which is not exactly really Donna. It's kind of a fake Donna. Kind of a fake giving. So that's, if this is for you, there is no need to worry about non-perfection. To live in this faith is not dual, because the non-dual is one with the trusting mind. The trusting mind, the Buddha nature. It just trusts. Doesn't know, it just trusts. This is the third turning of the wheel in Mahayana Buddhism. Now, Vajrayana, Tibetans say there's a different third turning. And I suppose they argue about it. Who knows? I wouldn't be surprised. It's the third turning of the wheel, the Buddha nature. And it comes in the third, fourth, fifth century. First starting in India, but not really catching on, and then really taking root in China. And it's and those of you who've been in study group with me, you can pronounce the word Tathagatagarbha, right? Buddha womb, Buddha seed. Awake womb, awake seed, seed of awakening, womb of awakening. And we can do a long etymological analysis of that, but I'm not going to do that this morning. And so we have a very, very important book in Mahayana Buddhism that comes very, very popular called The Awakening of Faith that is based on this. And then we have some more obscure books like the Tathagatagarbha Sutra, which is really earlier. Tathagatagarbha Sutra. Tathagatagarbha Sutra says that there's a seed, and the seed has a husk on it, and the husk is kind of rough and coarse, as husks tend to be. And just give a little water every day. Just give a little fertilizer, not too strong fertilizer, just a little fertilizer every day. Sink to it in the shower. And the plant will start to grow. But don't peel the husk away until it's ready to be peeled away. If you try to peel it away with your ideas of success or failure before it's ready to be peeled away, the little sprout will die. It will die. So just have faith in Buddha nature, in this little tiny seed, and do your practice. Do your zazen. Do your zazen. And another analogy that the Tathagatagarbha Sutra uses is the analogy of a wonderful statue wrapped in a filthy, disgusting old rag. Well, I don't know about that. Buddhists get kind of carried away sometimes. Just like in other religions, right? Get kind of carried away. I don't know. I don't think that little Tim is filthy, disgusting. Disgusting. You may. You may. But when the rag is removed, then the statue is just there in stillness. In stillness. Complete stillness. When we were studying Tathagatagarbha a little bit in morning study group, someone said, well, they like the Tathagatagarbha teaching, the Buddha nature teaching, because it reminds them of Christianity a little bit. And I think it could remind you of Judaism and Muslim too, because the God within. I didn't learn about the God within in my Unitarian church, so I'm sorry, but you guys learned about the God within. In my Unitarian church, we just studied bugs under the microscope and learned about Amenhotep, the Egyptian pharaoh who started monotheism. Oh, we learned a little bit about Jesus, but not the God within. But you guys, you're Minnesotans mostly, you know. You learned about the God within. I don't know if you practice it, but you learned about it. This is about practice. It's about practice. My grandmother used to say there was one priest in particular who really lived his faith. And you've heard that if you grew up, especially in Catholicism, really lived his faith. Really manifested that stillness. Didn't just think about it. To live in this faith is not dual. Because the non-dual is one with the trusting mind. So the trusting mind doesn't trust in something, because something is going to let you down. I don't care what it is. I'm sorry. Even if it's your bosom buddy. That something is going to be letting you down. You know that. You know that. I wish I didn't know that. I'm hoping it's going to change pretty soon. But that's just human beings, that's what we're like, right? That's what we're like. To live in this faith is not dual, because the non-dual is one with the trusting mind. And now here's the closing phrase of the Faith, Heart, Mind inscription. beyond all language. In it, there is no yesterday, no tomorrow, no today. So he returns to this refrain that he started with, which is, I guess, good Zen, if there's such a thing as good Zen. And it's not the refrain of the Buddha nature. It's the refrain of what? Of emptiness. Of emptiness. The second turning of the wheel. And in this case, Buddhism is really different from any other religion. Now, emptiness is not very popular in Buddhism, but the emptiness teaching, and Meister Eckhart came close to the emptiness teaching, right? When he said, in the Godhead, there's no trace of God. That's close. But what would Nagarjuna say about that? What would the Prajnaparamita say about that? They'd say, the Godhead is completely empty. And emptiness is completely empty. Forget it. I don't know. You have to get Meister Eckhart in the room to see if he could handle that, right? Maybe he could, maybe he couldn't. We can handle these teachings intellectually, but we want to inscribe them into our being. That's what this heart-mind inscription is all about, to inscribe them into our being. So it's not just a dead faith. So, emptiness. Deconstruct everything. Oh, there's a still point? What? Give me a break. Where's the still point? It's a human fabrication. Still point? Where is it? What is it? A construct. Buddha nature? A construct. I want to speak. I want to give a good talk. I really want to speak from my Buddha nature. Okay. What about big mind that doesn't have any perimeter? Is that Buddha nature or not? Oh, yes, that's Buddha nature. But if it has no perimeter, what is it? It's empty. It's vacant. It's completely open. And it doesn't even know it's open. This is a teaching that Buddha said, supposedly, in the second turning of wheel. This is not going to be popular. This is not going to be a popular teaching. He said, I won't get very many people come to talk to listen to this teaching. Less than are in this room now. He said, but I can't tell a lie. You know, he was like Abraham Lincoln, right? Only Abraham Lincoln didn't really say that. And Buddha probably didn't really say it either. So radicalizing all of our religious beliefs, all of our assumptions about who we are, radicalizing them and actually removing. So early Buddhism, before the second turning of the wheel, the second turning of the wheel is the beginning of Mahayana Buddhism, right? Emptiness is the beginning of Mahayana Buddhism. Not only is there no self, there is no anything, right? There is no anything. Early Buddhism, before that, which is fine, all of these are fine. Within Buddhism, you find these continual reformations taking place. Of course, you find them in Christianity too, but in Buddhism, they're more radical in that everything gets thrown out. Because the sign gets mistaken for what it's pointing to, the signless. And as soon as it's mistaken for what it's pointing to, then it is useless in a way. So, in early Buddhism, and many of you know this, there was an emphasis on the holy men, mostly men, but a few women, who have dealt with the fact that Buddha said everything is changing by retreating some from the world, being monastic, and trying to experience nirvana, blowing out the sense of separateness so that they could be free from everything is changing. That could be free from that. But then the emptiness teacher said, Well, you say everything is changing. But what's this thing that's changing? If there's a thing that's changing, it's not a thing. So this everything is changing is just another made-up story that you're telling yourself. It's great, but don't believe it. Don't believe it. You can have a nice dinner table conversation about it. It might help you for a little while, but after a while, forget it. It's just another fabrication, human fabrication. So that's why emptiness didn't really catch on in China. And that's why Buddha nature teaching really caught on in China. Buddha nature had just been barely introduced in India, and the Indians could get the emptiness better. The Chinese, they didn't like it. I'm generalizing, okay? I'm talking about the general population, right? But the Buddha nature teaching, they liked the Buddha nature teaching. Buddha nature teaching could go along with their commitment to progress, because you can develop the Buddha nature, to working in the world, because you can work with other people to help open their Buddha nature, to daily life, and it complemented Confucianism. They were Confucians. Whereas emptiness just trashed Confucianism, totally trashed it. All those rituals, all those ceremonies. And so emptiness teaching stayed in China, but Buddha nature teaching became the most prominent. And for us too, for most of us, Buddha nature teaching is more helpful than emptiness teaching. I mean, say, when I was with Suzuki Roshi that time, and I had been pleased with myself and wanting to expand my great enlightenment, or whatever, I don't care what. I had come to him, and instead of saying, "You have a great treasure," he had said, "Oh, forget it. Forget it. This is all bullshit, what you're doing. Where are you trying to go? Who is trying to go anyplace? Why do you even come here and sit in the morning? What are you trying to do here? Trying to get something? Trying to be holy? Trying to get enlightened? Give me a break." What would little Tim have done then? Probably. Probably. Yeah, yeah. Well, we need a Buddha nature teaching. It's not a bad teaching. We all need it. It's helpful. So, one teacher said that Buddha nature teaching, emptiness teaching, is about the emptiness of all form. Buddha nature teaching is about the form of all emptiness. So as Zen develops in China, called Chan at the time, there's a third element that James Mitchell thinks becomes very important in the practice of Chan and makes it uniquely Chan, besides emptiness and Buddha nature. And those of you who are in study group with me, remember it. And it's what? What is it? Someone from a study group.
Suchness.
Suchness. Or as it isness. Or as it isness. As it isness. And you have as it isness coming from the early sutras, but again, not emphasized in India, but comes very, very important in Chinese Zen and Japanese Zen and in American Zen, because we're pragmatists, basically. We're not really philosophical by nature. We're more concrete, as the Japanese were, as the Chinese were. So, as it isness, phenomena a priori. You know that we're an a priori? Before we put any conceptual framework over what is, immediately. Before we do that. Before we have any mental projection at all. So, things just are what they are. I am just what I am. You are just what you are. If you're carrying a lot of baggage, then that's your baggage. Don't say it's empty, or you don't try to get rid of it to discover the Buddha nature. You just, there it is. There's my baggage. There's my suitcase. Well, I wish it were a little lighter, but this is the suitcase I've got. As it isness says, you just Take care of your suitcases. You may wish you had less suitcases, but you have these suitcases. Take care of them. The clothes in those suitcases have some value because they're here. But you want to get rid of them. Emptiness, emptiness, emptiness. Or, oh, Buddha nature is when I'm still, then these, I won't have these suitcases anymore. But the suitcases probably are going to be with you for a long time. I'm sorry. I'm speaking from experience. And they're not bad. They give you some richness of memory, some richness which you can apply artistically to your life, which you can apply interpersonally to your life. If you use the clothes in those suitcases carefully, there's a lot to help you in those suitcases. So as it isness, no mental projections. No mental projections. So yesterday I was in my house and my wife was outside working in the garden, and I went over to my favorite white chair to sit on it. Lately I've been sitting in my favorite white chair quite a bit. And this was in my kind of my den. My wife had the door open on my favorite white chair. There was a huge slug. A huge slug. And you could see its trail, right? I could see exactly how it had gotten to my favorite white chair, where I sit when I need to rest. There it is. A slug on the chair. Here it is, a fan going back and forth. Will it? Sometimes it goes on me, sometimes it goes on you. Here it is. Nothing else. Nothing. So, I can get pissed about the slug being on my chair, or I can say, oh, it's all empty. Well, the slug is on my chair. I can say the slug is empty, the chair is empty, but that goo is on my chair. As it isness. Before you project anything, there it is, and just gently, just kindly, removing the slug, finding a nice little leaf outside for it to go under, and going back and trying to clean up the chair a little bit. That's all, as it isness. No projection, no division, no, oh well, did I act from the Buddha nature or not? You just are what you are. That's fine what you are. You don't need to be anything else. That's this teaching. You don't need to be anything else. So here's an interchange that we talked about in morning study group between Dawu and Shito. Shito is in our lineage, and Shito is the teacher. And you will see in this the teacher using the teaching of Buddha nature, using the teaching of emptiness, and using the teaching of as it isness. All three signs that point to the signless. Three signs. Dawu asked, what is the basic principle of Buddhism? Shito answered, you already have it. Dawu asked, is there a turning point upward? Shito responded, white clouds pass freely through the sky. Dawu asked, what is Zen? Dawu is getting a little pissed by this point, right? Well, at least that's what I always think when I come to this. What is Zen? What is Zen? Shito said, this rock. What is the path? This piece of wood. You see all three? You see all three there? Don't need to analyze it. So, once I was with my first teacher, my first year with him, and I didn't know him very well, and I walked into his office, because he didn't keep his door closed like I keep my door closed. He always had his door open. I walked into his office, and there he was, reading a letter in Japanese, a letter from Japan, I suppose, Must have been Japan. This was, he had been in this country for 5 years at that point. And he had not seen his wife in 5 years, I think. He had not seen his children in 5 years, I think. I think that's the case. And I noticed a little tears, just at the still in his eyes, just sort of up there. You know? And I wondered, what's going on there? But I didn't think much about it. The only thing I thought about it was, oh, he's crying about something. I thought Zen masters were beyond all that. That's what I thought in my first year of practice. That's interesting, isn't it? We think someone is beyond all that. We do. We project. Until we see what really is going on. And then he gave a talk. Next talk he gave, he said, well, when I talk with you, when I give you a talk, when I share with you about the Dharma, I am doing my best to write you a letter. I'm doing my best to write you a letter. And I don't know if it's especially good, but I'm trying to paint a picture for you. I'm trying to encourage you. I'm trying to show you the possibility of coming home. He said, that's all I care about. That's all I really care about, is to help you come home, to help you return to your home. That's the only care I have. And my letter might not be that good. I know that. But I'm doing my best to paint a picture, to give you some encouragement, to show you what it's like to come home. So the three types of letters that I'm talking about today, Buddha nature letter, it's a type of letter, or type of part of a letter, right? Inspiring. We need inspiration, because we have a hard time in our lives. We need to inspire each other. We need to help others develop the aspiration, keep the aspiration going, to practice so we can return home. But we need some truth-telling, too, sometimes. Emptiness, emptiness, emptiness. We need that sometimes when we're ready for it. When we're ready for it. And then also, let's not forget, as it isness, let's not forget taking care of this right here, this right here, this piece of wood, this fan, this glass of water. So Katagiri Roshi used to talk a lot, as some of you remember, about toilet paper. That was what when he was talking about as it isness, he would go into the bathroom, tell us about toilet paper. And, well, you know, he had never used toilet paper in Japan. They didn't have toilet paper in Japan until very recently, toward the end, before he left. So he didn't know about toilet paper. Here was something wonderful in the bathroom. He could tell us about toilet paper. He said, just this toilet paper, this is everything. Just take care of this toilet paper. Look at it. Look how wonderful it is. Don't use it recklessly, he would say. Remember that? Don't use it recklessly. It's everything. If you take care of this toilet paper, the world is being taken care of. As it isness. As it isness. This morning I was supposed to talk, I said I was going to talk about this book, Each Moment is the Universe, but then I got my dates mixed up. So I'm going to talk next Sunday about this book, Each Moment is the Universe, just a little bit. It's a labor of love on Andrea Martin's part. It's taking a lot of letters from home and trying to weave them together in a way that's somewhat coherent and somewhat inspiring and somewhat wonderful. And it is quite wonderful, I think you'll find. It's got lots of different stuff in it. It's about being time, but it's really just about returning home. That's all it's about. That's all it's about. And so next Saturday night, we're going to have a book signing, and people who were the closest disciples of Katagiri Roshi and his Dharma heirs are going to come say a few words about him. And Andrea is going to give a little talk, And then I'm going to give a little talk about the book on Sunday. And then Andrea is going to give another talk about it in September. And then we're going to have a whole practice period on this, on these letters from home, which Rosemary is going to co-lead with me in starting in early October. Okay. What would you like to ask about or comment about this morning on this warm July morning where it looks like we decided to do fans this year rather than air conditioner? That's an interesting idea. That's what my wife is into. But I won yesterday and we did air conditioning. Comments? Questions?
You mentioned air conditioning. It just reminded me of the toilet paper. And when I was a kid, we lived where we didn't have air conditioning until I was like maybe 11. Mm-hmm. The house we moved into in the city had air conditioning. And I just thought it was absolutely wonderful. Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. And still sometimes I understand
Okay. Well, we say, you know, in the Heart Sutra, emptiness is form, form is emptiness, right? And so let's think about it. All forms are empty. That's the emptiness teaching. All forms are empty. That they have no real being. That we create some kind of special form, like my chair, where I sit. Now, for the slug, was that a chair? The slug, that was just a crawling place, right? So we create these things. All of our forms are empty. That's the first one. Second one is that emptiness itself is form. That emptiness is form. And that is that the one that's harder for you? Yeah. So Buddha nature is that out of nothingness, always something is born. And that's Buddha nature. Buddha nature is continually being born out of nothingness or as nothingness. So Buddha nature is everywhere because it's the form which is emptiness, which is an expression of emptiness. Now Nagarjuna wouldn't like that because he'd say it was dualistic. But the Buddha nature people don't mind. Everything empty is expressing itself somehow. The fan is expressing its nature by blowing. It's completely empty. The air is completely empty. But as it catches the wind and blows the fan with the electricity, it's a form. It's a form. But it's empty. So it's just that same old Heart Sutra deal. Pardon? Yeah.
Okay, so if Nagarjuna would comment on that being realistic, I mean, yeah, it is, but we're talking anything in the relative world or the relative plane, the world of form, is realistic.
That's right. Correct? That's what the Buddha nature people say. So Nagarjuna, don't get hung up on this emptiness. As soon as you start negating, you forget to affirm. But Nagarjuna says, well, you have to negate, so that then you can see that everything already is affirmed. So there's just some little disagreement, but they practice with each other, and they...
But I don't see, what is he disagreeing with them, or is it they are disagreeing?
Well, they're putting it just a little bit of a different emphasis. Nagarjuna is saying, don't create some idea of, like, I should do zazen in this way. And if I do, I'll get some results. Or maybe I won't get some results. I should just do it because I'm being a good boy because Dogen said I should do it. Don't do that because you're creating something. It's all empty. Look into your need to create. What is this need to create that you have? And who are you, really, who needs to create? What are your insecurities? And look into that. question, question, question. Whereas Buddha nature says, Buddha nature teaching says, well, all that questioning might not be necessary. All you have to do is have a little inspiration, have a little aspiration, come back to your cushion and meet with your teacher and your friends, and sooner or later you'll realize that. You'll realize the same truth. So those are, they're different signs pointing to the same reality. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and he would point a little bit more with the other signs,
yeah,
because they were...
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And a good teacher integrates all these. That's why this guy, James Mitchell, says you take any dialogue in Chinese Zen and you find all three of these. The teacher doesn't know. The teacher is just speaking from here, and that's as it isness, or speaking from spaciousness, that's emptiness, or speaking from Buddha nature. And the teacher doesn't know, but using different ways of trying to be helpful. Well, of course, if the teacher is contrived and tries to figure out different ways to be helpful, well, maybe I should tell her about Buddha nature and him about emptiness. Then the teacher gets caught in their own fabrication, right? So the teacher has to really put the books aside before Doksan. Clear out. Does that make sense?
My back door inside the house, and so I thought I would pick it up gently and carry it outside like a good Buddhist, at least. So when I picked it up, and I gently cupped it in my hands, and I was opening the door, and it bit me really hard. And I injected some Zen. So I lost all of my stillness and kindness. I got really, really angry. So the question is, you do all this stuff.
Yeah.
Business and stillness.
Yeah.
And the world still bites you.
Yes, it may still bite you. It may still bite you. Life will bite you until you take your last breath, regardless of how great a bodhisattva or greatly enlightened you are. You'll get bites.
Well, I will say, you know, kind of the event of the story is that another beetle like that appeared a few weeks later. And I didn't squash it on sight. I used a piece of paper.
Okay.
Skillful means.
Yes, yeah. All right. Yeah. Good for you. That's a good story. What'd you say?
The score is now 1-1.
Yep.
I was reading an interview with this guy who was lifted and he wrote a book called, I think, The Biology of Belief. He's one of these brain science guys. And he was saying that, according to him, according to his data, his research, the unconscious mind performs 40 million, he used a huge number, actions, and the conscious mind, 40. So when you talk about our baggage, and then you talk about practice, does Zazen help us somehow intervene at that unconscious level? Because we can learn these teachings and we can try to apply them using our conscious mind, according to these guys. This conscious mind has been programmed by the ages completely.
Right. That's right.
So he tells all this.
Yes.
And then the interview says, but isn't it great that we're all moving towards a planetary consciousness where we're going to be awake and there's going to be light filled and you and I are there and isn't that wonderful? And I thought, well, gee, how do the rest of us get from?
Yeah. Right. Right.
40 million movements of the unconscious being awake.
Yeah. Well,
just
you have to have faith in Buddha nature.
Just have faith.
You have to have faith in no Buddha nature. Yeah, in your sitting, as you know, Susan, when you let go of your conscious mind, what happens often? Sometimes you get wonderful vacancy, but sometimes then unconscious stuff begins coming in. And sometimes it comes in too fast and too impactfully for you, and you want to get back to your conscious mind. Because the conscious mind is kind of controls it, right? So that happens in zazen, especially in retreats. I don't think it happens too much in daily zazen, but it does to some people. But in retreat, it really happens. And then, can we stay with that? Can we just be with that? Because that's part of this cleansing process. Is the conscious mind opens, calms down, the unconscious starts performing, the personal unconscious starts performing in a way that we thought, God, I thought I had gotten rid of all that. I've been practicing for 41 and a half years. Woo! There she is! But there she is. There she is. So, practice of as it is. Can I just be there with her? That's an expression of Buddha nature too. It may be Buddha nature that's forgotten that it's Buddha nature, but it's still Buddha nature. And behind her is him. But if we keep doing it, then emptiness, emptiness. And it's all empty anyway. It's really all empty anyway, but we don't see that because it seems kind of gruesome. It seems kind of scary. But it's all empty. It's just forms coming up. Conscious, unconscious, post-conscious, 10th level, 30th level. Cat Wilbur would say that you go from the pre-conscious to the conscious to the personal unconscious to the collective unconscious, beyond the collective unconscious to... And you can say that, that's fine, but don't start measuring it. If you start measuring it, you'll get all mixed up. Your zazen will just get all mixed up, and then you have to come see me, and all I'm going to do is say, like this. Okay.
Can I say something about that?
Sure.
When you were mentioning about what Ken Wilber would say, that might be what he would say with explaining that unfolding, but the more importantly, I think what he would say is, you know, the East has brought the study of body, mind, and spirit.
Yep.
And the West has brought the study and analysis of the psyche, the shadow.
Yep.
And the best way to do, and I've experienced that on retreat, that can be horrible stuff that comes
exactly.
up. But just sitting there, you can't see it. You call it a shadow.
Exactly.
You can't see the shadow no matter how much you sit. And if you do see that stuff that comes up in a retreat, that is no longer my shadow. It has now emerged from my preconscious, unconscious, and it's now in my conscious. But there's still all that 339,960 different shadows.
Yay! Good for you.
So there's, you know, so the Wilbur and that whole group say you got to exercise body, mind, spirit.
Oh, I completely. Shadow. I didn't mean at all to criticize that. I think it's a very sophisticated, intricate, and helpful way of looking at consciousness. Yeah.
But having that shadow in our awareness, if we can try to keep that like right in the back of our head, you know what I mean?
Yeah, but don't try too hard.
No, but, you know, picking up the bug. I mean, I understand that. I mean, you know, I mean, being aware of that, you have a shadow.
Yeah, right. So be aware, but don't try too hard. Because if you try too hard, you lose your awareness. You close down. And that's all.
Right. Trying too hard, we might close our awareness or lose our awareness and close down, but trying softly
to
keep just that awareness open of, oh, yeah, that's right, I have a shadow, and life's going to smack me in the head with a 2x4.
Sure.
And if I'm aware of my shadow, I'm at least know when I get hit that
of course.
It's not going to be as from out of left field.
Yeah, good. Good.
I think good. What he was talking about was habit energy, the incredible... Which some of it is deep shadow stuff, but some of it is just plain the way we do the same thing over and over.
And you know, and we have that habit energy that till we die, whether we're some great Zen teacher or not, we have that habit energy. So, but that's not necessarily bad if we can see it, because we can the habit energy kind of supports us. I mean, there's a downside. There's a downside to it, but some of the habits, like the habit I got from my teachers of just getting up for Zazen every morning, just getting up. Well, that's a pretty good habit. I mean, to a point. The point is that when I was my sickest this last time, I was just getting up, but I thought, well, everybody says I should be staying down. So then that's not a useful habit anymore. So I just have to be aware. I just take a deep breath, do my Zazen prone. Zazen does.